This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick here. Victoria is holding an inquiry into its sometimes controversial contempt laws. It comes at a time when 34 journalists and media outlets are facing charges for breaching suppression orders during the Cardinal George Pell trials.
Is the law of sub judice contempt still applicable in the modern age when you do have worldwide coverage of matters that are outside the control of the Victorian courts that are limited by their own jurisdiction?
Contempt of court, that's coming up shortly. The combative federal election is now finally behind us, but the legal fallout continues. A number of complaints could be heading to the Court of Disputed Returns. ABC News in Current Affairs has been reporting that Labor plans to challenge the Liberals' likely victory in the Melbourne seat of Chisholm. Labor's gripe is with the how-to-vote information posted by Liberal candidate Gladys Liu on WeChat, a Chinese social media platform. It appears that Labor is claiming that the messaging was misleading and deceptive because it told voters to vote one for Miss Liu and, quote, copy exactly to avoid an informal vote. Meanwhile, the unsuccessful independent candidate for the Melbourne seat of Kooyong, Oliver Yates, is lodging a complaint about Chinese language posters at polling booths in both Kooyong and Chisholm.
So in relation to the electorate of both here, Higgins and Chisholm, the Liberal Party put up a Chinese sign printed in the colours of the AEC right next to many of the signs next to the polling station signs saying the correct voting method in big headlines is to mark down one beside the Liberal Party on the green ballot paper. This was a direction to vote which was misleading and deceptive conduct because the way it was put out.
Oliver Yates initially complained to the Electoral Commission about the Chinese language signs which were in the same purple and white colours of the AEC How to Vote signage. But he had no luck. Graham Moore, electoral law expert at the University of Queensland, explains why.
Well, they had to deal with complaints like this on the day in real time. So their only concern was, should we go to the court and get an injunction to have these signs removed? The AEC said that we don't have intellectual property in the colours purple and white, although I think that's a bit curious given that they have chosen those colours deliberately to be distinctive. So in the end, the signs stayed up and we don't quite know what effect there is, but there are other legal possibilities or consequences.
And what are the legal arguments that Oliver Yates might put before the Court of Disputed Returns?
Well, with these things, there's normally two arguments. One is whether the thing was properly authorised, and I do see that those posters were authorised with a Liberal Party name, although in very small print in English at the bottom. The other question is not about truth in political advertising, but whether these signs misled people as to how to cast their vote. And there is a prima facie a decent argument that, yes, they looked like Electoral Commission signs telling people who understood Mandarin that to cast a correct vote, in other words, a valid vote, you had to vote one for the Liberal Party. Now, that's a bit insulting to some people from Chinese backgrounds, but there is a decent argument to suggest that these signs were deliberately designed to try and mislead electors as to how to cast their vote.
But what's the real world possible outcome of any kind of finding by the Court of Disputed Returns that some posters at some polling booths may have affected some voters? What could possibly come from this?
Well, it's very expensive to run an election petition, particularly if you lose. If a seat is on a knife edge, you can try and get evidence together there was a breach of electoral law and that breach was likely to have affected the result. But you have to show that the result was likely to have affected, not just that 10 votes here and there might have been affected. The alternative, of course, is to have the Electoral Commission refer the matter to the federal police, but we tend to see very few referrals and even fewer prosecutions in these matters. The time periods for prosecutions are short and the penalties are actually quite low.
I understand the signs in Chinese were used in Kooyong, a very safe Liberal seat, Josh Frydenberg's seat, and also in Chisholm, which was a knife-edged seat with a very high percentage of Chinese-Australian voters. So might an argument be made that if there was some kind of finding of misleading and deceptive conduct for the purposes of the Electoral Act, that there could be a re-election in Chisholm, but not in Kooyong?
That's right.
Have there been any similar cases like this before which have hit the courts?
So certainly on election day in the past, at state and federal elections, we have dodgy how-to-vote cards and signs. I can also think of examples from Queensland where under optional preferential voting, both major parties at different places and different times would put out signs that looked like the Electoral Commission signs, but with the words "just vote one" to try and minimise preference foes to their rivals. Those signs in themselves were dodgy. No matter, you know, you put an authorisation in very small letters on the bottom, people aren't going to see that. Gullible electors, which is part of the test on election day, are not going to understand that. And these kinds of practices really need to be squashed. One way to do that, which they're doing at state level, is to say you have to register all how-to-vote material weeks in advance. And then there's a time period in which there can be challenges and questions about whether the material is misleading. But I should stress, this isn't about truth in political advertising. This is simply about trying to police misleading people as to how to cast a formal or proper ballot.
You're pointing out there that there's nothing in our law that requires truth in political advertising or truth in political campaigning. And the Libs, for instance, would point to the ALP's Mediscare campaign at the 2016 election.
Not at the national level. At the state level, say in South Australia, there is a limited offence for materially misleading statements of fact in political advertising. But if you think about that, that only covers paid political advertising. It doesn't cover, for instance, shock jocks or what goes on in the media or party press releases. And it has to be a materially misleading statement of fact. If you think about a lot of political and commercial advocacy, it's not always statements of claims of fact. Sometimes it's questions of vision. And sometimes increasingly we're getting doctoring of digital manipulation of audiovisual material to misinform and mislead people.
Well, let's talk about that doctoring of audiovisual material. A huge controversy has just erupted over the weekend in the USA. Tell me about that.
Right. So the thing of concern in the US is, for instance, President Trump retweeting doctored audio of one of his rivals, the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives. It's been doctored to make her sound like she's slurring her speech. There's no suggestion the president's people did this, but it's circulating on the internet.
We want to give this president the opportunity to do something historic for our country while there are those in our family.
And it's a clear manipulation.
Why would you work with him if he, you know, and basically he's saying back to me, why would I work with you?
In a less kind of serious mode, we could think about visual images in Australian campaign. So those hundreds and hundreds of yellow signs of Mr. Palmer, they're all photographed from below showing him very youthful, virile and barrel-chested, not up-to-date photographs. Now, that may seem trivial. It's still a photograph of Mr. Palmer, but it has been visually created to try and make people think he's younger and more virile than he is. And this kind of thing goes on all the time in campaigning. How could you judge the truth value of that kind of visual presentation?
So there's no real way of counteracting both the very kind of serious misrepresentation of Nancy Pelosi or the less serious use of older photos by Clive Palmer.
Well, we could. We could craft a law that was about a bit like the old Section 52 of the Trade Practices Act. Are you misleading electors and citizens in an election campaign? But then the question is, well, who's going to apply that law? Because the Electoral Commission doesn't want to be drawn into that kind of political stoush. And the question then becomes, well, how do we assign truth value to things that are often puff statements about the future or statements about vision? Because that's a lot of what politics is about.
So the old saying, buyer beware, maybe we should have voter beware.
Caveat elector, yes. But, I mean, that's not good enough. There are no easy answers because it's you don't want to invoke government-level censorship, obviously, in election campaigns. On the other hand, if you just leave it laissez-faire up to the marketplace, we see what's happening increasingly around the world. You get more and more offensive statements, more and more false statements, and any hope that election time might be vaguely deliberative or at least informed is washed away. So we really need to nip some of these things in the bud, including, I would have thought, the Electoral Commission defending its own get-up or brand from people hijacking it.
Graham Orr, Professor Law of Politics at the T.C. Byrne School of Law at Queensland University, and he was speaking there via Skype. On RN or available as a podcast, this is The Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Last week, Victorian prosecutors dropped contempt charges against shock jock Ray Hadley and also the editor of the Melbourne Sun newspaper, Damon Johnston. That still leaves 34 media outlets and journalists facing contempt charges for breaching suppression orders during the trials of Cardinal George Pell. Now, interestingly, in December last year, just after Pell was found guilty by a jury, the Victorian Attorney General announced a review of the laws around contempt. And as part of that process, the Victorian Law Reform Commission has just released a consultation paper exploring the many complex issues around contempt of court. And contempt of court is indeed a very broad concept and can take many different forms. Lawyer Anna Beasley is the team leader of the contempt team with the Victorian Law Reform Commission. Now, Anna Beasley, you are a public servant. You can't offer an opinion or analysis about how the prosecutions arising out of the George Pell trial will unfold. But can you walk me through why were the suppression orders in place?
The suppression orders were put in place to protect the fair trial for George Pell.
There were a number of trials,
that's right. There was the first trial and then that was subsequently reported on, and then there was going to be a further trial in March. But after the first trial, the second trial was withdrawn.
So it was all about making sure that any jury in a subsequent trial of a second set of charges wouldn't be tainted by what they had heard about the first trial.
That's exactly right. The purpose of the trial and the suppression orders around those trials was really to protect the trial process and to ensure that the jury members made decisions based on the evidence put before them in court.
So give me a sense of the types of coverage that prosecutors say is contempt.
There was the front page of the Herald Sun had blacked out page.
A black background.
Black background said, we can't tell you this.
Well, in giant letters, the words censored.
Exactly.
And then after that, a caption saying, the world is reading a very important story relevant to Victorians, but we are prevented from publishing any details.
That's exactly right. What media organisations have subsequently been charged with is aiding and abetting contempt of court by overseas media organisations and for breaching the suppression orders. So what happened was that in the United States, the Washington Post reported on that case, and that was noted in the Australian newspapers.
So there's a very big conversation in Victoria around suppression orders and whether they are used by courts too frequently or in cases inappropriately. Now, that's a separate issue to questions around contempt of court. So let's stay away from the pros and cons of suppression orders. But these contempt charges, they've been brought by the prosecutor's office, haven't they?
That's right.
Okay, so it's not arising from the courts, from the judges, it's the prosecutors who
that's
are commencing
right.
these actions. And how will they be heard? Will they be all heard together, all 34 media outlets and journalists, or will they be heard separately? Will there be full-on trials? What will be the way that these contempt charges are addressed and heard?
It's unclear. At this moment, those contempt proceedings are at what we lawyers describe as interlocutory stages, and there's to be a further directions hearing in the middle of the year.
I guess it's unclear because we've never faced anything on this scale before.
That's exactly right. And the case is quite unusual.
Unique, I would have thought.
Yes.
What are the possible penalties?
In imposing penalties for contempt, the courts have a very wide ambit. It's a common law offence, and the judge hearing the matter has a discretion, an absolute discretion about what penalties can be imposed. They can include imprisonment, and that was something that happened a long time ago with Derryn Hinch.
Senator Derryn Hinch, who was in the media for many years, and I think he was fined and imprisoned for contempt for, I think, 12 days for informing his listeners that a convicted sex offender who was facing another trial at the time, incidentally, was running a camp where kids were attending. Mm. So what are some of the key issues raised in the consultation paper when it comes to this contempt by publication?
One of the key issues, and this is really highlighted by the Pell case, is the way information can be spread so quickly around the world via technology and the internet.
So you're trying to work out whether these kind of very ancient laws are still relevant and applicable in the modern age.
That's right. And also some of the assumptions underpinning those laws that jurors can or need to be sheltered, protected from external information, from information that is not put before the court, and that if jurors hear that type of information, they then will be unable to make an impartial decision. So that's part of it. The other assumption that underpins the law is an assumption that you can control the media and order the media not to publish certain materials, or that the law and the threat of going to prison as a result of being in contempt of court is a sufficient sanction to prevent reporting on matters.
And there's also that practical matter of what happens in a globalised world where people are accessing what the Washington Post or other overseas publications.
Exactly, and that's a question of enforceability. So it raises a real issue about, well, is the law of subjudice contempt still applicable in the modern age when you do have worldwide coverage of matters that are outside the control of the Victorian courts that are limited by their own jurisdiction.
Of course, the Victorian Law Reform Commission hasn't arrived at any conclusions. All it's doing is saying, look, there's an issue out here which we've been asked to raise, and that's what we're doing, and we're inviting submissions. Look, what's very interesting about contempt of court is that it takes many forms. So this contempt by publication is the one which is centre stage because of the prosecutions arising out of the Pell trials. But there's also contempt of court for non-compliance with court orders or undertakings. And there have been some very interesting cases in Victoria as well, haven't there, just recently?
Yes, there has. There was a really interesting case late last year concerning the owner of a tyre dump in northern Victoria. There'd been a long history of court proceedings by the council asking him to clean up his tyre dump, and he failed to comply with those orders. So the council then took court proceedings to seek enforcement of the order for the man to clean up the tyre dump.
To comply with the court order?
To comply with the court order.
And so what happened? He was found in contempt of court because he was just ignoring what
the
court was...
He just ignored it, and he ignored it for years and years. And the judge who heard the matter described his behaviour as a perverse refusal to accept the jurisdiction of the court.
This was, I think his name's Shannon James Sidebottom, and his tyre dump is in the town of Numurkah in Victoria. What did the court do?
So ultimately the court convicted him of contempt. The company was fined, and he was sentenced to 4 months imprisonment.
And what, there's a proper trial where evidence is heard, or sort of people come before the court and say, look, here's the paperwork, he's ignored the court orders year after year after year?
There may be submissions, but the process is heard by judge alone, and the procedures for the court to follow are set out in the Supreme Court rules. So there are some rules around this for this type of contempt because it's disobedience of a court order.
In the Pell case, I'm imagining it's not going to be just a question of a judge banging their gavel and saying, you're in contempt. Mm. There's going to be some serious addressing of these fundamental issues. Mm. But I guess here where it's much more straightforward, the authorities and the local authorities and the courts would argue, this Shannon James Sidebottom, they could just look at the paperwork and say, right, you're off to jail. You're in contempt of court.
Potentially, yes. And it's at the discretion of the judge who's hearing about whether or not they wish to call evidence.
And I've seen pictures of this giant tyre dump in Numurkah, and it's kind of sort of on the edge of town, and it's enormous.
Yes.
And probably presents a massive fire hazard, I would have thought.
In fact, there were fires in 2013, which put the locals at risk.
So there are cases of contempt for non-compliance with court orders, but there's also something called contempt in the face of the court, which I understand arises from time to time.
That's exactly right. And there's another Victorian case of Slaveski, which has a long history and was a very, very serious case of contempt in the face of the court, where Mr. Slaveski, over a period of a year and a half, sent threatening emails to the judges, and indeed when he was in court he made violent, abusive and threatening comments, and he also, by his emails, was attempting to obstruct the administration of justice.
So that's a little bit different in the sense that it's not non-compliance with orders, it's actually kind of threatening judicial officers.
Correct.
And this, from my memory, because I think we've covered this case before, he's a vexatious litigant who's been in and out and in and out and in and out of the courts for many, many years. Mm. And I think at one point he said to the judge, if you're going to take my property, I know where you live and I'm going to take yours. Something along those lines. Is that correct?
That may have been the case, yes.
So we've been talking about Victorian cases. Mm. This year there has been an extremely interesting case in Brisbane in the Federal Circuit Court. It was a case of Stratford and Stratford earlier this year where the judge has been found to have gone way too far in terms of a finding of contempt. Well, what happened in that case?
Oh, in that case, the accused failed to hand over financial records that were required as part of the proceedings.
The family law dispute.
Yes. That's right. Mm. And as a consequence of that failure, the judge hearing the matter proceeded to imprison the man for a maximum of 12 months with a 5 months custodial period.
And even his former wife, who was actually in legal battle with him, mm. thought this was a terrible idea because it would kind of have a huge impact on their kids, and she supported her former spouse's appeal.
That's correct.
This matter went on appeal. Where did it go to on appeal?
So it went to the full court of the family court, who said that the judge had no legal power to make the orders and that it would be an affront to justice to leave them in place.
In fact, I think that when they overturned the decision, they said, quote, what happened here constituted a gross miscarriage of justice.
That's right. They said it would be more difficult to envisage a more profound or disturbing example of prejudgment and denial of procedural fairness to a party. And they pointed out that the man had not been given the opportunity to be heard.
So effectively, the judge had just made some kind of very quick decision without inviting him to defend himself.
That's right.
Look, Anna Beasley, what does this and the other cases tell us about the processes for dealing with contempt of court?
It tells us that the processes are highly discretionary and depend on the views of the judge hearing the matter or having the disruptive or abusive behaviour or the failure to provide documents or comply with a court order. It tells us that it's a discretion for that judge to decide how to deal with it, whether to deal with it as a contempt, and then what the processes and what the penalties are to be imposed where they form the view there has been a contempt of court.
So part of the process going on in Victoria is to say, well, look, maybe we need to have clearer processes and a clearer understanding of the way this... Of course, it's not in statute, is it? It's all kind of in common law, isn't it?
Well, it's funny. It's a really funny area of law because there is common law contempt, which is judge-made case law decisions, and then there are bits of it, pockets of it, that are actually restated in statute.
And these are the sorts of questions about whether we've got the right legal architecture for dealing with these very, very complex issues.
Correct.
That's basically what is in part of this law reform process.
That's right. And we're being asked whether there is a need to put in statute Victoria's common law of contempt.
Now, Anna Beasley, contempt takes many different forms, and you highlighted one form of this before when you mentioned Mr. Slavesky. You talked about people being kind of disruptive or disrespectful or insulting and sometimes even threatening in a court. There are different levels of that disrespect, I suppose. There was a Queensland case in Proserpine earlier this year where, you know, hey, it didn't sound too serious, perhaps. Tell me about that case.
So that was a case before a magistrate late last year where an accused went to court wearing a T-shirt that said villain, and the magistrate hearing the case asked the man to go outside the courtroom, take off the T-shirt, turn it inside out and come back into court, and he refused. The magistrate said, I'll send you down, I'll get the police in and make you do it.
And send you down to the cells?
Send you down to the cells.
What happened?
So he then, through his lawyer, the lawyer then came back into the courtroom and said, look, he understands the seriousness of it, and he apologised.
So he purged his contempt,
as
they say.
So he purged his contempt. That's exactly right.
And what, they then rearranged for the court hearing to come back another time where he could come back more appropriately attired?
That's exactly right.
Do you have many cases of that kind of low-level contempt where a judge or a magistrate just says, I don't like the way you're addressing me, or I don't like the way you're addressing me, I don't like the way you're approaching the court, the way you're dressed, for instance?
You hear of it anecdotally, but of course those are matters that are heard in the lower courts, so in the Victorian Magistrates Court, and so they don't receive the level of coverage. They're not reported in the case law unless they become so gross, as was the case with, say, Mr. Slavesky, where he had really serious behaviour that he undertook before the magistrate's court that included threatening behaviours and also a long series of emails to the courts.
And what happened to Mr. Slaveski? Was he imprisoned for his contempt?
Yes, he was. He was imprisoned for a minimum of 15 months. That was the sentence. It was a 23-month imprisonment with a minimum of 15 months before parole, and that covered all of the types of contempt that he'd been charged with.
Coming back to this case in Queensland, I think the young man's name was Jamie Lee Engle. Was there any discussion about what his intention was by wearing the villain T-shirt? I mean, I don't know. Was he trying to be disrespectful and inflammatory, or was it just something he'd done without giving much thought to it, or trying to even be a little bit funny without being contemptuous?
The way it was reported was that to him it was just a T-shirt. It appears that he hadn't even turned his mind as to whether or not it could be perceived as being offensive or disrespectful to the courts.
And is intention an important question, do you think?
Intention in this area of law is not relevant.
Aha. And is that an issue that do you think maybe might be addressed by this inquiry?
Yes, it is one of the questions that we're looking at as part of this inquiry. It's a very interesting question because it is counter to the requirements of proving an offence to criminal law, for which many of them require there to be an intention to perform an act.
Anna Beazley, we've been looking at very lot of different areas. There's another form of contempt called scandalising the court. And I think about 2 or 3 years ago, three Victorian Liberal politicians, Alan Tudge, Michael Sukkar and Greg Hunt, they were hauled before the Supreme Court for what's known as scandalising the court because they had, I think, told journalists that the Victorian courts were very weak on terrorism sentencing. So what's this idea of scandalising the court?
So this is an area of the law of contempt that is concerned with protecting the integrity of the courts and ensuring that they are not brought into disrepute.
And what happened in that case?
So in that case, the ministers were asked to explain their comments before the court and they were asked to apologise, and eventually they did. And because they apologised, contempt proceedings were not proceeded with.
Did they come into the court themselves or did their lawyers just come in? I've forgotten.
No, it was just their lawyers. So it was just the Commonwealth Solicitor General who appeared on behalf of the three ministers. And so Dr. Donoghue said, "We offer an apology. We never, that is, the ministers never intended to influence the court." And they apologised, saying they intended to exercise great care in the future. The court's concern was that the ministers had failed to respect the doctrine of the separation of powers and that they had also breached the principle of sub judice. So the courts were concerned with a number of different types of contempt in that case.
That ignited a debate because some people said, look, the politicians have to kind of respect the courts. On the other hand, some people said, look, the courts are being precious. They should be able to deal with people making comments about their past sentencing histories, rightfully or wrongfully, I might add. So, again, these are questions that you'll be looking at in this inquiry.
That's right, because there's a real question about how do you balance the need for open justice, that is, that courts and court proceedings are open and transparent and can be reported on, with the need to ensure the proper administration of justice, to ensure that a jury in a criminal trial is able to make a decision based solely on the evidence put forward in a courtroom. How do you balance those sometimes competing principles?
Lawyer Anna Beazley. She's team leader for the Contempt of Court Inquiry, currently being conducted by the Victorian Law Reform Commission. And we have a link to the Commission's consultation paper on the Law Report homepage. And there's still time to have your say on these issues. The closing date for submissions to the review is the 28th of June. Big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to sound engineer this week, Ari Gross. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.